Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Jesse.
And today, in our very first episode ever, we're discussing Shadow and Bone by Leigh Bardugo, the first book in the Grisha series. We talked about Bardugo's impressive world building, Alina's journey, love triangles, and obvi representations of race, class, and gender. But before we dive in, Jesse, will you summarize this book in three sentences or less?
Yes. Shadow and Bone tells the story of Elena, a girl who thinks she's ordinary, but who actually has these extraordinary powers that could be the key to saving her world.
Initial reactions. What did you think?
Okay. I really loved this book the first time I read it. And then the second time I read it for the podcast, I was kind of lukewarm about it. It was good, but it didn't hold my attention as much as the first time.
This is my first reread after reading all of the Bardugo's books, like all of them in the Grishaverse. So Six of Crows, this whole trilogy, then Language of Thorns, the Book of Short Stories. So I kind of have like my nostalgic rose-colored glasses on a little bit.
You have read all of the Bardugo books.
Well, but she has this other series that I haven't read yet.
Okay.
So I like this book, but I love the series. So I can't really see it in isolation that well, or I guess that's not my default mode.
Right.
Like I default to, oh, this book sets the stage for so many things that are like so cool. And we don't get that deep into all of these really interesting aspects that we're going to talk about. Right. But then I'm like, oh, my gosh, things get so much more complicated and so much more interesting and frustrating, but in good ways, and character development and all these other things happen. And I'm excited for you to read the books and then for us to talk about them.
It's kind of like people who read Harry Potter. No one's favorite Harry Potter book is Sorcerer's Stone.
Right.
But I think because I think it sets up the world really well, and I get really excited to read it because I know it starts all of these chain of events and we're introduced into this magical world. But I haven't met anyone whose favorite is Sorcerer's Stone.
Right. And you only have that. That's only like an a posteriori, like after you've read everything, then you can come back and see like why that was necessary.
Right.
To the start of the journey. Okay, so let's talk about world building in our first segment called Through the Wardrobe. Imperial Russia is the touchstone for Ravka, and there's a few things that I really appreciated about this. First, I love Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings, etc. It's problematic. Obviously, they are problematic in certain ways, but I do love them. But it was nice to read some non-medieval-based fantasy.
Right.
I really liked that.
Right.
And I think this choice is like helps draw the reader in because they're accessing a different world that they haven't necessarily seen before, which they're not familiar.
Yes.
Unless they know a lot about Russian history, and then maybe they're like, oh yeah, all of these things make total sense.
Which I know nothing about Russian history, so Kelly really brought this to my attention because I didn't even think of that. I just got, this is a fantasy novel.
It's perfect. It's on the cover of your like book of the original book, right? Like the
I did
like
not
domes.
Pay attention to the cover when I got the book.
That looked like the castle in Moscow, right? And I'm making
St. Petersburg.
Thank you.
I know something about Russia.
No, but geography.
Yeah, I'm bad at geography. I just told you I was really bad at geography. I don't know where it is, but the Kremlin?
Yes. So that's sort of like style. I mean, that's even on the like on the cover of the original book, right? And
right.
Then I mean, it's not on the...
What's on the cover of your book?
It says Shadow and Bone in large letters.
Ooh.
And by bestselling author Leigh Bardugo. And then it has this sort of like watermark stag, which for reasons that if you've read this book, you know why that's important. You know why the stag is important.
You should probably state up front that there will be lots of spoilers for this book. It's only going to be spoilers.
Yeah, read the book.
All spoilers. If you didn't read the book, this is... not the
or
podcast.
If you don't feel like
you.
Reading the book and feel like listening to us talk about it, then
that's
cool
true.
Too.
Very true. Or if you love spoilers. I don't like spoilers. Kelly's okay with them.
I am. I'm totally fine with them.
She spoiled the first season of Great British Bake Off for me.
I didn't mean to. It was a mistake.
It was a mistake. It's fine. It's fine. No regrets.
I guess this is what I was saying is this is a choice that draws the reader in because the fantasy world is different than that medieval fantasy.
Right.
And I should say like a typical like Western reader, right? Which we often encounter a very limited range of culture representation in our books.
Yes.
fantasy can draw from limited archetypes a lot of the time, and our TBRs can sorely lack diverse perspectives, which is something we're trying to change in this podcast, right?
We're going to fix it.
We're doing our bit.
Yeah.
And the second thing I really like about this, about Bardugo's world building, is that she doesn't exclusively use Imperial Russia to create this sort of like aesthetic. She also implements elements of the social and economic reality, like the wealth disparity and the class hierarchies. And we're going to go way more in depth into this in later segments, but I just did want to mention that. And then there's also attempts to represent other cultures. This is the first attempt in the first like window we see into the Grishaverse, but you get the Shuhan, talk about Kirch later, which is important in Six of Crows, Fierda to the north, and there's like Six of Crows opens up the geography of the world a lot more, but this is the very first time we get exposed to what the Grishaverse looks like, and it's very much centered in Ravka.
We have to talk about the Shadowfold because it's a really cool part of the books. Kelly said that she heard Leigh Bardugo in an interview say that she was going for If Darkness Were a Place. And that's kind of, I'm guessing, the...
It was like the inspiration, I guess, behind it.
For the Shadowfold. And so through the Shadowfold, for me, it's not very clear in the story whether the Shadowfold is the reason for the war that's going on or if there's another reason for the war. But there is a sense of urgency due to the Shadowfold for the war that's happening in their world.
The Shadowfold is a catalyst for a lot of those issues.
Right.
But then also we get when the Darkling's talking about how other... He's talking about how Grisha are viewed in Ravka versus right. in other areas. And he says the Shuhan like want to experiment on them medically and extract right. their like magical essence.
And then the Fierda just kill them.
Because they think they're just witches and witch hunts and burning
witches.
Witches. Yeah. So I guess it's like it also... I got the sense that these problems also have to do with like where Grisha are
right.
in the magical world and how they're... It, whether they're like accepted or like how they're inserted into the hierarchy, right. I guess.
And they don't really explain the war because it is kind of important to Alina and Mal's story because they're both refugees who have been taken in by this wealthy duke and they're in like an orphanage for people who are refugees, for children who are refugees. But we don't really know why they're refugees, which is kind of strange.
And, yeah, we don't know much about their backstories.
Yeah, really, but we know the war's been going on since they were children. Their families are dead because of the war.
Yeah, we know it's been going on for generations, right? Because the Darkling's ancestor made the Shadowfold.
Ancestor in quotes.
Yeah, right, scare quotes. Very necessary scare quotes.
Right. Background.
Mm-hmm. And so there's this obvious belief, at least by the non-Grisha and Alina, who was raised in obviously a non-Grisha, non-magic household in the orphanage at Karemzin, I believe in God or gods. God. I don't know. They don't really talk about God, but they do talk about saints.
They talk about saints and praying. Alina talks about the place where people are praying before they go into the Shadowfold.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just implied that it's a monotheistic religion, although it's not explicitly stated that I can remember.
I can't think of a polytheistic religion that has saints. They just have multiple gods.
Right.
So I'm gonna...
But no one seems to care about God. They care about saints.
Right. You're right. Maybe they turn the saints into type of gods?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Not sure.
Religion can function as an explanation of where the magical powers come from, but they also have this scientific aspect that we'll talk about later. But we don't really know if the Grisha believe in higher forms of power. We don't really see them with their saints and their iconography. It very much seems to be a class-based system.
Right. And we'll talk about the Apparat later, but he is a religious figure that the Darkling is working with, but we don't really know. Those are some nefarious intentions going on there.
I think that, yeah, it's
a means to an end for both of them.
It's power grab.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we've kind of been circling around this, but the religious system in the book seems to draw heavily from more orthodox forms of Christianity, like Russian Orthodox yeah. or Catholicism even, right? Because these saints, we have their iconography that's really important. People are like selling relics and purchasing relics and the like worshiping at altars and those sorts of things. It's not just like it's not a like a Protestant style
no
religious system.
Or even like the people at the party at the end of, well, I guess it's more towards the middle of the book, where Alina really shows her powers as the sun summoner to other people. They want to touch her, kind of like we see in modern times with like the Pope.
Right. Yeah. This is a celebrity status.
Right. Right. Religion absolutely. And celebrity, I guess, often go together.
They do. It's true. Like eventually, yeah, when she becomes like Sancta Alina, which becomes right. way more important later in further books in the trilogy. It seems to me, even from the very beginning, that Alina gets this sort of, bad pun, holier than thou, where she thinks, like almost looks down upon and is disdainful of these people who attribute her existence as a sun summoner to like a miracle. I don't think she understands this, like, this movement of the lower classes or like more common people to explain everything with religion.
Which is really interesting, because at some point she talks about needing maybe she should pray as well. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that she sees that she maybe has some kind of belief in these things, but at the same time she doesn't want to be the one who's believed in.
Yeah, part of her struggle, right? That's a huge part of her struggle as a character.
I'm not at that part yet, so I don't know. Talking about world building, so something that we see a lot in fantasy is this thing where there's magic, but there also seem to be myths within the magic. So there's some things that are true and there's some things that are myths. So I kind of think of like the Chamber of Secrets. In that book, people don't think the Chamber of Secrets is real, but it obviously turns out to be real. Or like Luna Lovegood believes in Thestrals and Hermione's like, that's crazy. That's not a thing. Mm-hmm. We see this in this story where Bagra talks about Morozova's herd, and she thinks that it's a crazy thing to believe in, and she talks about how it's up there with unicorns and the Shuhan dragons. And it's interesting to me that you can be so entrenched in this magical world and still some things are relegated to the impossible. Maybe we'll see this less as the books go on, because obviously Bagra has her own things she's trying to work out behind the scenes with Alina and the Darkling. But I do find it very interesting, this struggle between what's magical real and what's magical myth.
That's interesting, because I guess what it points to is that magical systems aren't like open necessarily, right? They're kind of closed systems. Like there are things that are allowed. There's like almost rules, right?
Right.
There's things that are allowed and are, I don't know, view as true or that we know to be true. And then there's things that are outside of the like realms of the closed magical system.
Yeah. I feel like often we see this in fantasy as a way to foreshadow something is going to be real, or as a way to give us information, which is not a bad way to go about moving us into a specific way of believing things. But it's also kind of a weird thing that they all seem to do. Fantasy novels, I mean.
Yeah, I guess that there has to be some sort of negotiation between like all bets are off. We believe in everything now.
Right.
Everything's allowed.
Right.
And these barriers, these like kind of boundaries of the magical system.
You can't have a world where everything is just possible.
No, where would the conflict be?
Right. Exactly. But anyways, I thought it was really interesting way to go about that. And obviously, at least Morozova's herd turns out to be true, which opens a possibility to me that unicorns and dragons will also be true.
Listeners, you should believe in unicorns. I certainly believe in unicorns.
Why not?
Why not?
I've never seen one. Prove to me they don't exist.
Exactly.
Wands out. This is the part when we discuss all things magic. In the Grisha world, not everyone has access to magic. The Grisha are the magical elite, and they're coveted by the crown, and they're coveted for their combat abilities. But simultaneously, they're feared and largely admired by everyone else. So we see different levels of magic and even different levels of magic within the Grisha.
So we first meet the Grisha at the very beginning of the book in this before chapter, when the examiners come to the orphanage at Keremzin and they test the children for powers. And at least when I was reading, I felt this sort of like awe and mystery that I was like mirroring those feelings that like the boy and the girl have,
right.
Which are, we know later that they are Mal and Alina, right? When the Grisha were coming, when the examiners were coming, I don't know, you just felt this sort of like reverence, and they're a little bit scary, but still very alluring. so we're getting the same information as Mal and Alina. We're kind of in the same boat, right? Because we don't know about the world, really. And so we're learning for the first time, just like they are. We find out that the children are how this sort of system works, right? They Grisha come, they examine, they take children away, and they go to Grisha Hogwarts, which is what I'm going to call the little palace.
Grisha Hogwarts is the perfect name for where they go. It's exactly the same.
But one thing that was like frustrating to me, and it's probably the point, is that the examiners rub their prestige in the kids' faces. You know, they talk about I can't remember if it was Mal or Lena, but one person asks like, what happens when you go? And they're like, oh, you get all these food and all these clothes, everything you could ever want. And it's like, you probably should think before you talk to orphans about all of your like prestige and your clothes and your food.
But they also in that moment say, but only one of you, as if there's no way possible both of you could have these powers, mm-hmm. which is also interesting that they haven't even done the test yet. And two, they're assuming, well, two people can't be great. Only one of you
can be. But that like obviously doesn't pan out until much later. Right.
Right.
It does kind of show that. I don't know. I kind of got this sense that the Grisha were very also like a classed system, right? That most of them seemed to come from, it seems to be like a hereditary power almost. It's maybe they come from like Grisha families, because it seems like a lot of the people that we meet at Grisha Hogwarts, aka the Little Palace, are pretty privileged, at least economically.
Well, and it's not really stated, at least in this book, whether they have this sense of privilege because they feel special because they were taken out of their homes. Because they do tell us that they take care of the families. Like, the families of Grisha want for nothing, is what they say. So mm-hmm. I don't know if any of them come from lower, like, socioeconomic classes before they were Grisha, and now their families are pulled up out of poverty because their kids are special.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm thinking about Harry Potter and this like obsession with like magical purity.
Right.
Right. And about like wanting to breed the like pure blood wizards and like mudbloods being awful.
Right.
But like it's a weird tension because it doesn't seem to be like that obsession with magical purity. But at the same time, there is a very much an elitism and a privilege associated with being Grisha.
Right. Because the Grisha obviously think they're better than the non-Grisha. And then they obviously have that class system within the Grisha themselves. But we don't really see them interacting with people who are non-Grisha except for people who are part of the military.
Well, and their servants.
And their servants.
They have servants all over.
Right, yeah, they do. But we don't hear any of them talk.
No, and they don't have names.
And they have no names or anything. There's nothing about them.
Treat service workers like people. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thanks. Another thing that I thought about when I was reading about the Grisha examiners is that, do children exhibit powers or hints at magical capabilities before examination? Or is it sort of thing where you have to go through the Grisha examination litmus test? Like you have like the secret kernel of power and only a Grisha amplifier can access it or something.
And it seemed to me like they had to be tested, but I don't know if at some point, because are the Grisha examiners going around testing every child in this whole universe? You know, like within Ravka, and are there even Grisha, Infierda, and Shuhan?
Well, I think that they're used for different
things.
Things.
So in Ravka.
Well, it's not like the Grisha here aren't being used. They certainly are.
No, yeah, they definitely are. They are just less aware of it.
Right.
So I think that in this instance, I think like people like Anakuya, she would have realized that the kids had powers before, if they could exhibit them. But I don't know if they waited too long. Like, would Alina just magic? Like, would she exhibit her powers anyways?
Right. Eventually? Yeah, would they just come out?
Right.
Do they manifest? Or is it the sort of thing where, like, I have to hold your hand and then I get to, like, feel your power? I don't know.
Hold my hand without my permission. They didn't even ask.
They didn't ask. Mm-mm.
Rude.
Non-consenting.
Yes. But there's a lot of non-consenting in this book.
So, like, I feel like the Grisha examiners are magical metal detectors and they're not very good at their jobs because they didn't detect Alina.
Alina has so many problems with her powers to begin with that I feel like it's like frustrating to me that she was able to hide them from the examiners. You know what I mean? Because if she had these powers but it was a child and was so bad at controlling them, I don't understand how she can also hide them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess it gives the child, Alina, a lot more agency than adults typically give children to like actually make decisions about their own future, because that's what she does. We don't find that out until later, but she actually just
decided.
Right.
But more agency than they also give her when she's an adult.
Fair. Than she has at Grisha Hogwarts.
Yeah, no, none at all. Yeah, so it was also interesting to me that I don't understand why Mal's power, like his tracking ability, isn't considered a power. You know what I mean?
I do. I don't want to spoil anything for you.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think it's important because it demonstrates that, like, they're only looking for, the Grisha examiners are only looking for certain types of power. They only view certain types of knowledge as valuable and only certain types of contributions as valuable. Whereas I don't know if they would necessarily look at that as anything to develop or exalt.
Okay. Well, then I'll say it this way. It's interesting to me that Mal's power to be able to track things so well is not seen as a power in and of itself by the Grisha examiners, because he becomes such an important person later for the Darkling / Alina in finding Morozova's herd.
That's true. I guess I don't know when he starts tracking. He's like 8 at this point, right? Aren't they really young at this point?
Yeah, they're, well, I, yeah, they're
or both, something like that.
They're 8-ish.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I really liked about this magical system is that there's seemed to be like a lot of thoughtfulness and care on the author's part. There's like even theory, which as a Ravenclaw, totally love. Yes, read all the books, read all the
you
theory.
You are such a Ravenclaw.
I am. But we accessed it because we are seeing the whole thing through Alina's perspective, right? It's this first person book. So we're learning at the same time that she's learning as the readers. So this theory refers to the magic, Grisha magic, as the small science. And I think it's basically quantum physics. What do you think?
You're probably right. I mean, they are literally, like, what is that word?
Manipulating?
Yeah, manipulating matter. Yeah, like, they talk about how you can't create something from nothing. So even when Alina is trying to create sunlight in the darkness, she has to pull it from somewhere when she's, like, working with Bagra.
I guess, I mean, don't at me, but I guess it's not, like, technically quantum physics. I know that.
I know nothing about quantum physics.
I mean,
so
like atomic level manipulation, right? So, but at an atomic level, there's no difference between like what I would do as a heart render between like the organic material of our bodies are made of versus like the what your, I don't know, cat palace is made of in the corner of the room right here. So I guess it's like, it's not technically quantum physics, obviously, because it's magic. Everyone is magic. And
but they're magical people who can manipulate
different
quantum mechanics?
Kind of, right? They distinguish three different types, the corporalkai, the etherealkai, and the materialkai. And so the corporalkai manipulate the human body. They can be heart renders or healers. It's sort of like very, I guess, binary of the things that they're allowed to do with like the human body. But can they manipulate the body of any living organism, or is it just human bodies?
Well, I don't know. I feel like if they can manipulate anything, then shouldn't they be able to find the herd more easily? Is Mal going to end up being Grisha? Is this like...
I'm not... You don't want spoilers.
I don't want
to tell
spoilers.
You anything.
Nobody wants your spoilers, Kelly.
Okay. I'll try, listeners. Wait, so we don't have an answer to that question. We don't know.
I don't know.
I think it's limited to humans. We don't see it otherwise in the books.
Right.
But
unless
it'd be cool.
Mal is, and that's how he finds things.
The etherealkai are called summoners, and they command elements in like a traditional sense. Tidemikers, squalors, Inferni. But is there an earthbender equivalent as an Avatar The Last Airbender fan?
No.
I'm curious.
Never seen it? Read it? Never seen it.
It's a TV show.
Oh,
it's a children's
cartoon. But it
was
also made into a movie, right? That everyone hates.
The movie was unfortunate,
yes. With that guy from Twilight.
And so lastly, we have the materialkai, which are fabricators. And they manipulate metals, glass, and other types of materials. Hence the name.
Materials. What do you think Genya is?
Genya. I only know that because I listened to the audiobook.
So what do you think? What is she part of?
She
starts off with the white.
It talks Kefka? About her. Kefta.
Kefta.
Mm-hmm. Kefta. It talks about her being a tailor. That's what they refer to her as.
So does that make her...
I think that they mentioned that she's a combination of... She showed an affinity. I guess that's like what you are. As a Grisha, you show an affinity for one of these like three types of orders. And she showed both materialkai and corporealkai because she does use the like gold leaf,
right,
to and like the rose petals or the flower petals or whatever to change people's faces, or to like make your eyes bluer or your cheeks rosier or whatever. But so the Darkling, I guess, like let her pursue her unique abilities, and the white is the servant's color. That's why she wears white.
Oh, I see. Because then at the end, she's in a red kefta,
right,
with blue yarn
stitching
around the outside, and I didn't know if that was like a sign of her being part of two different groups. So when I was reading this, I had a lot of trouble keeping track of what the different groups were, because they give you this list at the beginning, and I felt like I should like tear the page out and have it next to me the whole time, because I could not keep track when they started getting into it. And
despite the color coding system?
Well, that's the hard part, because in the beginning, like in the list, they don't list the color coding. And fair. So I just ignored it all. I'm a bad reader sometimes. And I just...
Bad Jesse.
I know.
Bad
and I reading. Just pretended like I knew what they were talking about, even when I didn't.
Just go. Just smile and nod. She's doing it. You can't see. You can't see. You're listening. So there's a commonly understood hierarchy in these different types of Grisha power. So the Corporealkai seem to be first, and then Etherealkai, and finally Materialkai. And I guess this sort of hierarchy is marked by the proximity to the Darkling. I know they're all, like, at the Winter Fate, they're fighting about, like, who gets to enter first and who gets to be closest to the Darkling. And then they're also, like, this is Grisha Hogwarts. At Grisha Hogwarts, they're, like, fighting about whose table gets to be closest to the Darkling and all which this is business.
Like Grisha Dumbledore.
Oh my god, he is like Grisha Dumbledore. Everyone wants to be around him. Everyone's power hungry. He's mysterious. No one knows anything about him.
No, nothing.
What is the logic behind this ranking system? Any ideas?
I don't know. Corporealkai? Anyways, they do things with the body. The Etherealkai, what do they do? Etherealkai?
Like elements.
Right. I don't know. Obviously, they think that being able to manipulate bodies is much more important than elements or materials.
Or I guess, like, directly being able to, like, kill or right. affect human life.
I'm guessing maybe the Darkling came up with this system, so of course he thinks killing is most important.
Yes. Alina also, so, like, dovetailing into this, like, hierarchy conversation, Alina chooses to wear blue.
Instead of black.
Why?
Because all black things are bad, apparently, in fantasy worlds. In this fantasy world.
Dark equals bad.
Bad equals evil.
Equals scary.
Yeah. So Alina won't wear black. The Darkling is the only one to wear black, and he is evil.
Does he have? Yep. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Grisha are tools. He uses the Grisha.
As weapons.
Mm-hmm.
He is.
So does the King.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting because the Grisha don't seem to care. They obviously realize what they're doing, because we see Alina's two friends that she makes that are also summoners.
Nadia
and Marie?
Yes.
Yes, I remember something. Nadia and Marie, they know that they're going to be shipped off somewhere. I think those are their words, like to one or two of these different places within Ravka, because they're learning the different languages. Oh, it's Marie and, like, Sergei or whatever.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And they fight about which is the better language to learn.
Right.
Which is, like, just learn a foreign language.
Or you learn both of them. Right. Wouldn't that be more helpful?
Or, like, why do we have to have a hierarchy between different languages?
But they obviously know they're being used as weapons for the Darkling, but also don't seem to care.
Yeah, they're going to be stationed somewhere. It's a military academy, essentially.
But one that they have no choice in joining.
Fair, because they're recruited from, I mean, there's a draft.
Right, but a child draft? They're drafting children.
Mm-hmm, they
8-year-old old children.
They are, but not just Grisha. I mean, I guess the draft for the Muggles is later.
Yeah, I haven't seen, I don't know if we see that in later books, but I don't know how old Mal and Alina are when they get pulled into the...
I think they're 16-ish.
Are they in the First Army?
Yeah.
First Army.
First Army is the non-magical people.
So even there's a hierarchy among them. I'm guessing because the King's in charge of everyone. There's a First Army and a Second Army, the
Darklings
Muggles, and then the Grisha.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Wizards. Let's go with witches.
Wixes?
Yeah.
Gender neutral?
Gender neutral. In some religions, witches is gender neutral.
That's true.
So,
yeah. And then we also learn that magic isn't confined to the humans or the Grisha. Otherwise, amplifiers wouldn't be a thing.
Right, and they don't really, aside from Morozova's hurt, the other amplifiers don't they don't tell us that they have magical powers. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. Well,
doesn't, like, Ivan have bear claws or something?
Yeah, and... but are the bears magical? Or is it just, is this amplifier the best amplifier because it's a magical creature?
Well, I feel like they have to enhance the magical abilities. I mean, right. That's what an amplifier does, right? But how could it do that without itself being magical?
Yeah, it was just interesting to me that they didn't pick a magical animal. Maybe all animals are magical in this world.
That'd be really cool.
Wands away. Okay, now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in a segment we're calling Get Me Kylo Ren. Why Kylo Ren? We know he's annoying and problematic, but we like him anyway. Don't at us. Plus, we needed a cute segment name.
When I was reading this, I noticed that belonging is pretty much the crux of a lot of the conflicts in this book. Alina kind of does this dance back and forth between losing herself and finding herself in order to fit in at Grisha Hogwarts, and Mal's this, like, fuckboy, basically, so he can fit in with his dude bros in the First Army. And Mal and Alina are orphans, so the whole belonging issue is even more important when you look at it in that context. And the Darkling doesn't belong, so he's a dick about it and goes, like, undertakes a really ambitious project of creating a place for people not, like, adjacent to him, not just like him, because he is this sort of, like, singular figure.
Right.
Until we learn about Bagra.
So there's this interesting part where Alina, talking about belonging, where Alina, she takes pleasure in catching men off guard.
Yes.
And on page 8 to 9, she says in the exposition, she says, "People, particularly big men carrying big rifles, don't expect lip from a scrawny thing like me. They always look a bit dazed when they get it." So I just thought that was interesting in the context of her being part of the First Army and trying to be this strong character who is exhibiting these things that we would call maybe male traits, which I don't think we should, you know, stick to gender,
like,
binaries.
Masculinized.
Yeah, exactly. But then when she's with Jenya, she is excited for the first time to put on makeup and do her hair and wear a dress and all those kinds of things. So it's interesting that depending on where she is depends on how she tries to fit in.
And then there's the whole situation when she decides to wear blue because she wants to identify as a summoner. She'd rather be part of a group instead of being singled out wearing black like the Darkling. I guess all of, like, the intra Little Palace,
right,
conflicts are about, like, who's, I don't know, where do we belong all in,
right,
this hierarchy in this larger community of people.
Right, and she won't go train with them down by the lake because she doesn't feel like she's good enough to be with them. Like, she doesn't fit in because she's not showing her powers yet.
Well, yeah, because she couldn't do anything.
No, she can't. She can't because
for, like, a lot of the book, she can't do anything.
Well, because there's no guy around to make her make it happen.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. We have thoughts.
So many thoughts. And so it's also interesting, we talk about how, like, the Darkling is basically Kylo Ren. So this is an aptly named segment. For our first episode.
Yes.
It's our first episode, and it all fits so perfectly. Because if Kylo Ren were an ancient, mysterious, dapper, shadow-making, power-hungry politician, that's the Darkling. That's exactly what he is. They both wear black. They both suffer from delusions of grandeur and have a soft core that they don't want anyone to see. So they double down on being huge assholes.
Yeah, they make a lot of mistakes.
They do. We don't get a lot of backstory on the Darkling, though, at least in this book, where we do for Kylo Ren.
I can't remember. I'm glad I'm rereading, because I can't really remember if we get that much more information besides the exposition that Bagra gave. We get way more information about, like, Bagra's backstory. And so in that way, I guess you get more of what's happening to the Darkling, because she's his mom, right?
Right.
So that's, like, his history.
And if you understand your parents, then you understand all the ways that you are fucked up.
Thanks, therapy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what therapy is for.
Shout out to therapy.
Shout out to therapy and, like, just working through your parents' stuff. Mm-hmm. Please do that.
But what gets interesting later, specifically about the Darkling, is his relationship with Alina.
Later in this book or later?
Later, later. Later.
Okay. I'm really interested because I also seriously ship Kylo Ren and Rey. Just putting it out there. Don't care.
And Hermione and Draco.
Yes. I'm a Draco fan. Please send me all your fan fiction. going on talking about villainy. We also get the apparat, and he's just depicted as this creepy religious zealot. And Alina feels uncomfortable around him. When we think back to talking about religion, she doesn't really seem to be on the same level as everyone else, as the non-Grisha people, at least.
Right. So maybe she's not, I mean, I think it's important to consider that maybe she's not just uncomfortable with this one particular person. He's like a figurehead. He's a religious figure.
Which maybe she's just uncomfortable with all religion. But I wonder if she's encountered other religious figureheads in the past. Because Anna Kuya talks about keeping the Duke in their prayers at night. So they're obviously praying. I wonder if they also had to go to services or what goes on in this world with religion.
We don't know.
We don't know. Either way, we don't find out much about him, and he's a real creepy dude. We interrupt these deep cuts to bring you Show Us Your Fix. Which character do you think deserves their own storyline? Let us know by finding us on Twitter or Instagram at JKMagicPod.
King of Scars is my dream fanfic spinoff.
I don't know what this is. I should have looked it up.
It's the next book that she's writing, and It's getting released in 2019. I can't fucking wait.
Can you tell us what it's about, or is it going to spoil something?
We haven't met that character in the series yet, so I'm not going to say anything. Me. So I vote Bagra.
Okay.
And Jenya.
I want more Jenya. For me, she was one of the more complex characters in this story, so I want more of her. She has this interesting backstory. She's basically doing the work that the Darkling needs done on behalf of the king. I don't really like her with David very much. I don't know. Let's see.
Because there's like, what's there?
Nothing. There's nothing there. He returns none of her feelings, and maybe that's the point.
I just feel bad for her.
Maybe that's why I feel bad for her. She's going off after something that's never going to happen.
Well, yeah.
Or no. Maybe does happen, and don't tell me.
I'm not telling you. But there's, I think the whole point, like one of the points about this character in particular, is that like she's seen by so many people as like an object, right? And is beautiful, and she curates her image that way, right? That's obviously like important to her, because, and that's also her power, right? So it's a core aspect of her in so many different ways, and he doesn't notice,
right?
I feel like that's why she's drawn to him.
Yeah, that makes sense. But maybe it's hard because we're with Alina the whole time. So, of course, we don't see Jenya and David together. But I would like to see them together. Maybe actually talking about things other than what he's making for Alina.
Thanks, fanfic. Back to the deep cuts. Because just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. I'm going to start talking about class. It's hugely important in this book, even though the story makes us think Alina is the center. I think there's an enormous class dynamic because she's representative of a certain economic class, right? But she's operating in these realms of people who are in a wildly different class than she is. And nobility, those are the circles that she's moving in through for a lot of the book. It's depicted as totally out of touch with what's happening in the rest of their country. There's like opulent parties at the ugly palace. What do they actually call it? I don't remember.
The Grand Palace?
Grand Palace?
No, that sounds like grandparent.
You probably should tell us, listeners. You probably know better than we do.
What do they call the other palace?
Yeah, we don't know. We just read it. We should read better. The soldiers in the First Army take issue with the king's inattention to the war effort. There's this interesting moment when, after Alina and Mal's capture, Ivan reveals that he follows the Darkling out of spite for the king's wars. He mentions his brother, his father, and his uncles were all killed or injured. But like, hold on, I thought that there was a draft not on the basis of like the gender that you identify as. So conscription doesn't seem to be restricted to men or boys. So why only male relatives? Why have they only died?
It doesn't make any sense, because it's not like Alina is the only woman we see. Now, I'm not sure we see any women. I guess we would call them like infantrymen. I think we see another female map maker. So maybe it's possible that the women are forced to do other jobs than like carrying a gun and killing people.
Interesting. Because there's plenty of women in the Second Army. So, like, literally everyone at Grisha Hogwarts, all the women at Grisha Hogwarts are being trained to be in the army, in the Second Army.
Maybe Grisha Hogwarts is, like, more, you know, woke.
Equitable? Question mark?
Yeah. Let's put a question mark there, because when we talk about Jenya, I'm not sure.
And another thing I thought interested, similar to that, is that, like, question of gender in the ranks of the army is the oprichniki, which are the Darkling's private guard, all seem to be male.
Yeah.
Back to class. There's the huge contrast between these lavish displays of wealth, like at the Winter Fete, and the abject poverty of the villages and farms. And also, Alina realizes that Grisha have clothes that can't be penetrated by bullets. Their kefta are like Kevlar?
Something.
Or something. That would be very heavy and hot.
Yeah, so maybe something stronger than Kevlar. I mean, they have magic, so they're just...
That probably helps.
Weightless magic Kevlar.
Fabricators.
Yes, yes.
But the First Army doesn't, and she takes issue with that. She's kind of like, why? I guess it becomes very apparent which lives matter.
Right. Well, and I wonder, since the Darkling is technically kind of in charge of the Grisha and the Fabricators, do the First Army and the King even know it's possible for them to make this bulletproof material?
Like, is he hiding it from them?
Right.
Could be.
Wouldn't be surprised.
Because you know he's gunning for power.
Right. Yeah. So, of course, he wants probably more First Army men to die. First Army people. We're going to call them Army people. Because he doesn't need... They're disposable to him. He's not concerned about any of that.
Yeah, he doesn't interact with them ever. I mean, he has servants, but
right,
those don't matter to him.
And we also see it even in the food that they eat on a day-to-day basis in the little palace, because Alina is eating food that she, like, they have sugar, and that's exciting to her because they don't have sugar because they're rationing things everywhere else.
It's wildly expensive.
Right, and they have, like, houses that are just growing these flowers.
Yeah, that food is an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that it's important in this discussion about class, because it's like fake peasant food, right?
Right.
She talks about it being pickled herring, and she hates pickled herring, and they have like oatmeal or whatever, porridge, is that
bread.
What you call it? But then it is contrasted with things like sugar.
Right.
And so it's like, no. And they, was it Marie or one of her friends was talking about, the Darkling wants us to like be more connected to the people. And it's like, well, then maybe outfit them with armor so they don't all die.
Right.
And don't just like your fake solidarity because you also eat porridge.
Continuing on with class, there's also a divide between non-magical, we're gonna call them muggles, people, and the Grisha. And we kind of touched on this earlier, but the Grisha are held up as being above the non-magical people, and maybe just below the King and his army, because they have this distinction of the First Army, and I'm guessing that's first place. Like, they are above them and the Second Army. In the beginning of the book, I didn't understand that Ivan was also Grisha, because the Darkling is like, watch what you're saying to her, like how you talk to Alina, because she's Grisha. And I didn't realize they're supposed to be like this interconnectedness and politeness that they show towards each other that maybe they wouldn't show to a non-magical person.
That's certainly what it seems to be implying.
Right.
Is that like, oh, now I have to follow this different code of conduct and I treat this person very differently.
Right. And we don't really see this as much. Obviously, the non-magical people who aren't part of the First Army, they start holding Alina up as a saint. So they obviously aren't all afraid of the Grisha, but the Grisha don't think that those people are worth their time.
They do get, we get a little bit of like the superstitions. I can't remember what that character's name is, but at the beginning when they're in the camp and like there's that one really superstitious person who doesn't like the Grisha for some reason. Like, she thinks they're super violent and manipulative.
Yeah, she's like she's like the other female map maker.
Oh my God, yeah,
but
right.
I don't remember what her name is.
Yeah, we don't remember her name. She had a name though. We just don't remember it. Should we move on? Should we talk about gender a little bit?
Let's talk about it.
I mean, these are all interconnected. Hey, intersectionality. So one thing that I was really interested in when I was reading, was a big part of my notes, was these different versions of masculinity that we see depicted throughout the novel. And the two most obvious, playing off our love triangle, which we'll talk about later, are Mal and the Darkling. And for me, there are certain parts of the Darkling's character that strike me as feminized, and so characteristics stereotypically associated with femininity. So, for example, he cares deeply about appearances and performance. He's elegant and sensual and charismatic. And I'm also going to play off this totally obvious point and say that the Darkling is very much incorporates this like bad boy aesthetic. He has dark hair and clothes. He's emotionally unavailable, mysterious, and dangerous.
All of my favorite characters.
And I guess what made me think of the Darkling as feminized is mainly this opposition to Mal, who's this rough around the edges outdoorsy type. He's this trekker. He's like a guy's guy in the army. And he's, you know, sleeping around with all these women. They're all like looking at him outside. Zoya at the beginning, before we know she's Zoya, is like staring at him outside of her carriage window or something. And Alina gets jealous. But I guess it was that this sort of opposition between the two that highlights the different forms of masculinity that they, I don't know what word I'm looking for.
Show?
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also really interesting because the Darkling is the more feminized character.
Right.
And the bad guy. So what does that say about our views on what makes someone masculine? I don't know. You know, it's interesting that they've decided that this character would be bad and also like feminize them.
I hadn't really thought about it. I guess this like bad boy aesthetic is kind of associated with that sometimes.
Yeah. They often turn out to be good later, you find out, but they're not always good in the beginning. And there's like these preconceived notions that because they have like this bad boy aesthetic and they are like more feminine and concerned with their looks, that they're also evil. Like you even kind of see it when you think of like Harry Potter, like Tom Riddle as a young boy is talked about like how he charms people and he like looks put together, like all those things, and he turns out to be evil.
And charisma is definitely one of those things that's, I mean, obviously you can deploy it for good or for evil, right? But it's associated with those types of characters, and that can be very dangerous,
right?
But also alluring, and that's part of why we find them attractive, I guess.
Yeah. Although we don't know enough about the Darkling for me to be attracted to him in any way, shape, or form.
There's some amazing fan art out there.
Maybe I should look it
up. You should totally look it up. It's really good.
So there's also within the story this patriarchal view of how sex is treated. So Alina is meant to feel ashamed for wanting to have sex with someone she doesn't know very well, and then again later for not being with Mal. Or for not wanting to be with Mal, for wanting to be with the Darkling instead of Mal. So she feels bad for that later.
Gasp.
Which is not okay. So in the story, she talks about how if she to do the sensible thing would be to lock her door and not let the Darkling come into her room that night. And she says,
can I come to you?
Yeah, exactly.
To me. We won't go there.
Anyways, why is it like sensible? You know, like these are two consenting adults. If she wants to have sex with him and he wants to have sex with her, just let those things happen, you know?
Right. But then we get way more information later in the book, right? That he might have been manipulating her the whole time. And
oh, I have so many thoughts on that because I'm not sure if he is or not.
Yeah, I'm very conflicted about it.
I don't know. Either way, Jesse and Kelly, J and K, we approve of sex positivity. We are not here for any of the shaming.
Nope, I'm not going to shame you.
No shame. We're going to talk about race now. This is Jesse, and I'm going to talk about race. I'll start us off on race because I am the mixed person in this group. I'm half black, half white. So I'll start off talking about race. So this book seems to have no people of color at all, which is a little frustrating. Hopefully we'll see more in another book. So when I first started reading the book, I was hoping that Zoya was going to be a person of color because she's described as having black hair, and something we don't see naturally occurring in people who are not Asian or black is black hair. But then the book also makes an effort to not to describe skin color. We never get a really full description of Alina. This was really frustrating to me the whole time I was reading because we don't really, there are a couple characters who we get very descriptive attributes for and not other ones. Do you remember them describing her in like detail at all?
Alina?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it talks about her hair.
Right.
Being like...
mousy brown.
Yeah. Which I have that. So, I mean, not really. My hair is blue right now. We only see her described through her own, like, the lens of her own opinions of herself, right? Because it's a first person book. So she talks about how basically all the things she's unhappy with about herself. And it's about how she's pale and has mousy brown hair that's like,
oh, she not is healthy. Pale. You're
yeah,
right.
Doesn't so it
she
talk must, about her being pale?
Yeah. So she has to be white. But also the book does this thing that a lot of books do where they don't give specific skin colors for all the characters. And I think it's because we live in a world where we just assume whiteness, which is especially frustrating. And we see that come up in other fandoms, like with the topic of Hermione possibly being black. There has been great artwork coming out like this past week.
Amazing.
A beautiful black Hermione, which why not?
Exactly. Well, and also how in the Harry Potter movies, the minute Lavender Brown became a speaking character, yes, she changed from a black actress to a white actress.
Exactly. So I think there's this assumption of whiteness that happens in storytelling. So even Alina, she talks about being pale at some point, you know, and some people of color can also be pale.
Fair.
But if you're white, you probably don't think about the fact that you're white very often, is an assumption I make about white people.
I'd say that's probably true. The racial coding doesn't affect me in the same way.
Right.
I'm white, by the way. Kelly listeners.
Fine. With blue hair.
With blue hair.
For today.
Yes. Might change. And I guess it just doesn't affect your day-to-day existence in the same way.
Right.
So you don't. And I mean, white supremacy is the system that we're operating in right now. And it that means, part of that means in our literature made by white people just kind of assumes that whiteness is the default.
Right.
And I guess it's important to have sensitivity readers for that reason.
Exactly. I had a friend a while ago and she asked me what I thought was a pretty good question about my reading experience and asked if I assumed that characters were white if they didn't tell you the skin color. And I also assume that characters are white. And I think part of that is because I live in a world surrounded by white people and white people writing the stories. And I don't know what that says about myself, but I think without those descriptions, you don't see yourself because it's not, I mean, as a person of color, you don't see yourself as the characters because that's just not what we're often given.
Right. Not given that room.
Right.
Versus for me, there's no barrier for me seeing myself as Alina or for like white women, I guess, white girls reading this story. I think it's really important to think about that, like, we shouldn't just assume that whiteness is the default. You should have to call that out as well.
Right.
And I guess maybe that's part of, like, possibly moving towards, like, making white supremacy less powerful.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think it also operates, what you were saying earlier, is that, like, white supremacy, I guess, why you also default the characters to white, is that it's not... those sorts of systems they don't just operate on people. They operate like in people, internalize them, right? It's like internalized sexism or misogyny or bias in general.
Yeah, hopefully in the next book, we'll get some more people of color. Kelly has made me feel a little bit better about that, but I wish it would have been included in a first
Mainly
book.
In Six of Crows.
Okay, so in a whole different series.
Basically.
Continuing on with race, it's a little bit more complicated in the fact that some of the Grisha are able to change how they appear. So a part of me wonders, can they change their skin color?
Could Jenya change someone's skin color?
That's what I'm wondering.
I don't know how many tailors there are. She's the only one we see. I hope she starts her own school.
That would be wonderful.
I mean, it makes sense if you would... She uses like gold leaf to change Alina's hair and she changes her own hair. She makes her skin more pale. Like it talks about that.
Which is interesting because she makes Alina's hair more gold. And they do talk about a point where they make someone's eyes more blue.
The queen's eyes.
Which means they're like increasing the attributes that make them white.
Oh my God, totally. They're like exponentially increasing their whiteness attributes.
Maybe there's really bad white supremacy. All white supremacy is bad, but maybe it's more pervasive in this world in such a way that they have to increase what makes them white.
Yeah, it just shows that like even in this world, subconsciously this system is operating, right? Because those are the traits seen as valuable. The queen wants to be, like, she obviously wants to look younger, but she also wants her eyes to be bluer, and she wants her hair to be brighter, and she wants her, it's all these, like, traits typically associated with whiteness.
Yeah. So then the other thing is the Darkling and the Shadowfold. Both those things end up being considered evil. Maybe we'll learn more about the Darkling. Maybe he has some, I don't know, maybe he'll end up not being evil. But the colors, dark colors, so black for the kefta that the Darkling wears, he's called the Darkling. And then the Shadowfold, which also insinuates something that's dark, are all used to signify evil. So in a book with no black or brown people in it, what do you think this says about the use of colors, like dark colors in this book?
I think it's relying on these sort of age-old archetypes that come from, I mean, Western culture in general, right? Since colonialism particularly started being a thing where you're valuing light skin over dark skin and making judgments of, like, moral judgments about these people on the basis of racially identifying them. That's why I'm excited to read books by, like, other more diverse authors, you know, too, because I think that this changes very radically.
I wonder what we'll see is different in books written by white and black authors on color in general, like, not of people but of things. Like, what colors will they use to signify what's evil?
My guess is things get more interesting.
So now we're going to talk about feminism. We're both feminists, if you didn't know.
Could you tell, listeners?
Could you tell? But, like, good feminists. So we get some really awesome, badass characters who really come into their own through the story. But at the same time, Alina suppresses her powers for a boy, Mal. She gets her powers back to save Mal, and she's willing to relinquish them again to save Mal. I don't really like this storyline of Alina coming into her powers and giving them up and suppressing them, all these things for a boy.
I think it also gets, that dynamic gets even more important and strong when you throw the Darkling into the mix, right? Because he's the person who can force her to reveal her powers in the Grisha tent.
Yes.
Like, she can't access them or something, or she tries not to. It's a violation of her consent.
Yes.
Just had that thought. The Darkling also makes her feel assured of herself and needed. And that's not only because he is a physical Grisha like a Grisha magic amplifier.
Yes.
It's because he gives her, or he makes her feel special and seen. And
yes.
That's not something she's ever been before. And the reason she's able to throw off the Darkling's power after he puts the Morozova's stag collar on her is to save Mal again in the Shadowfold. Again, can she just be powerful for her own self?
I would be so happy if she was. Maybe she'll learn to use her power in such a way that she's not reliant on these, either Mal or the Darkling.
But I also want to, like, make sure that I'm not, I'm kind of, like, in tension with myself, because her giving up power for, like, love and to save someone else is not bad in and of itself, right? I also want to be careful that I'm not, like, promoting this super individualistic paradigm, like, oh, you can only be out for yourself, there's no community orientation at all,
because right. That is a choice she makes,
right? But I do think that this is all an intentional part of her character development, which is, like, I'm in a privileged position to be able to say that, right? Because I'm looking back on the books after having read the trilogy, but she's at this point, she's very tied up in understanding herself and her values. And by the end of the novel, she has slightly more information, I guess. But the process isn't over yet. It's probably a good thing, because the books are boring with characters that don't change.
Of course.
But we're allowed to be frustrated at the same time.
Yes. Because the other thing that frustrates me is beauty is so held up within this world. And that's not to say you can't be a feminist if you're beautiful. You know, that's, like, an awful stereotype that...
Or if, like, that matters to you.
Yeah, exactly. If those things are important to you, that's okay. You're allowed to think things are important. But it almost feels like we're supposed to think Mal missed Alina the whole time they were apart. But it also feels like a 90s movie where Alina isn't noticed in that the way she feels like she needs to be noticed until she's beautiful.
Until her glow up.
Until her glow up.
Where she like literally glows because she's a sun summoner.
Yes. And not only that, Mal is jealous because the Darkling wants to be with her.
And also this like darkness contaminating lightness. That's a whole other dynamic that we didn't even talk about.
Didn't talk about with race. Yeah. I mean, the Darkling is white, but he is coded as dark.
Like he has darkness coming off of him.
Yeah. Even there's that discussion between Alina and Mal where he says it's okay that Alina fell for the Darkling as if she needs his permission.
Yeah, fuck that.
Yeah, exactly. And she's like, I can't believe that you're okay with this. And he's like, well, I'm not yet, but I will be. As if she is contaminated by him.
And that's part of it is like she needs the space to go through her own shame spiral.
Right.
And to figure out what that all meant.
But she shouldn't feel ashamed. I mean, maybe she was manipulated.
So. She was manipulated. Maybe. Yes and yes. She was manipulated.
She was. She didn't have all the facts about what was going on.
No.
I just want Alina to, you know, really come into her own and be powerful on her own.
And I want to see more of these other women, other like non-male characters, get a little bit more airtime.
Especially because the women we do see, there's a lot of fighting between them and a lot of cattiness behind back, which is, and like people being friends with Alina just in order to get closer to Mal. I wish we just saw more genuine.
Yes. Women. Oh my gosh. I forgot that happened in the, or like her life before Grisha Hogwarts.
Right.
But then in Grisha Hogwarts, they want to be close to her to get closer to the Darkling.
Yeah.
I was like, do they care about her at all?
I don't know. Especially because Alina is a pretty good friend with Jenya, at least, because I think that's her only genuine friend other than Mal, and that she cares for her and she seems to want to at least try and make her feel better about certain things. So now we're going to talk about illness. There's something to be said about how illness is treated in this book, and both Kelly and I are people who deal with chronic illness. Both have autoimmune diseases.
We do.
So in this story, Alina looks tired, sickly, underweight until she accepts her greaser power. As if to say we create our own illness by not being true to ourselves. And Alina's struggle to access her power is a crucial part of her character development. There's a scene outside of Bagra's hut when Alina realizes she chose to shut down her power the day the Grisha examiners came to the orphanage. So there's this weird mix of subconscious and conscious choice, and it's very much a finding yourself moment, but at the same time I feel like it speaks really, really poorly to what it means to have illness, especially an invisible illness.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point about like we create our illnesses by not being true to ourselves, as if like, I mean, obviously chronic illness is a part of yourself, like that is your true self. I mean, it's not the entirety of it. Obviously we contain multitudes, and I don't know who said that, so I'm quoting someone and I don't know who they are. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
But that is, it's a really interesting point that there's, it's almost this like we create the problem, and it's, but it has a physical manifestation. That's why it comes across as like illness, right? And then when she finally accepts it, she's beautiful. And isn't she? Doesn't her like appearance change? Yeah, yes. It says that she like fills out.
Yeah.
And she stops looking sickly, and she like actually has some color because she
sleeps
like
better.
Oh my
the
God.
Bags under her eyes are gone.
I think she just got some really good meds.
Yeah, which is like all you ever need when you have chronic illness is for them to figure out what you need to make you feel better. But as someone who's like, I'm a pretty small person, and part of that I think is from my illness, because I just sometimes I can't eat, you know? And so as someone who like sometimes gets comments about how small they are, I'm like very resentful of these kind of things where it's like, but if you weren't sick, you'd be fine. And I can't tell that you're sick. This is just who you are. So let me comment about what you look like.
Yeah, there's a different thing about like being coded as sick.
Yes.
Versus not. And I guess with invisible illness, I mean, obviously depending on where the illness is, it can, you look more or less sick.
Right.
Right. But with Alina, she thought that she was this person the whole time, and she hated herself for it. That's the thing. She didn't accept her. She didn't like her scrawniness or anything like that. She's not like embracing it. She's only like she only gains self-esteem when she has like all of this power.
Right. Which, like, does that say something, like, if our illnesses were just gone, like if they just disappeared, would we
have superpowers?
Superpowers. Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about sexuality, asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own. In this, we have just a normal, good old-fashioned love triangle. Or maybe it's a lust triangle because Alina doesn't seem to really have decided who or what she wants.
And that's fair. Hang out with that indecision, I guess. Experiment along the way.
Have them both if you'd like.
Damn straight. Yes.
I'd be really happy if she chose to just, like, have sex with both of them and decide afterwards.
I want to talk about Mal and Alina's moment in the wooded glen in the Petrozoi. This whole, like, I'm sorry I didn't see you monologue by Mal. And I'm, like, very at war with myself over this scene. I was listening to it on the audiobook rereading for this podcast, and I like paused it because I knew it was going to happen afterwards, and I was like, no, I just want to hang out in this like suspended wooded glen. It's 90 degrees in Colorado, but I'm going to pretend like I'm in this like snowy wooded mountain glen looking at this beautiful animal and like having this confession of love and just stay that way because I don't want it all to end. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, Alina's like hopeless and like desperate, and Mal's general thick-headedness is annoying, and it's like, I'm sorry I didn't see you, and I kind of want her to just be like, yeah, too fucking bad, man, and let's just like do the quest that we set out to do. Why does this have to be a romantic thing?
Especially because he says the words, I'm sorry I didn't see you, as if like, I see you now that you're pretty.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And now that another man wants you.
Which is really problematic.
That is problematic. But he also shouldn't be shamed for having, like, a sex life, right?
No. Oh, of course
not. I know. I'm like, fighting with myself. I wasn't saying that you were saying that.
Yeah.
But that, I'm sorry I, like, didn't know that I had feelings for you until you were gone, I guess. And then I realized that, like, wait, those, like, vapid sexual experiences didn't do anything for me. What I was really missing was human connection from you.
Right. And I guess it is, aside from the time that Alina tells him about where she cuts her hand, you know, the like cut she's always like touching. Aside from that, they don't seem to have really spent any time away from each other, at least not a lot of time. So maybe he really does just miss her, and it's not, maybe I am just like putting my own thing on it where I'm like, why do you only like her now that she's pretty? Like, why are you falling into these tropes when really he just didn't know he would miss her so much? Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
It's a really interesting, now I hadn't thought about this before, but it's a very blended friendship / relationship, like romantic relationship.
Yes.
It grows out of their friendship, right? It wouldn't have existed otherwise. Those two people wouldn't have gotten together had they not grown up together. I'm conflicted.
I don't have any strong feelings for Alina and Mal, so I think she should just give up on men altogether and, like, be with Jenya. Please send me your Alina Jenya fanfics.
Send us. Find us and send them to us. I like the, I love this ship because Jenya and Alina's scenes are so intimate. Jenya is, like, touching Alina's face in this really, like, sweet way, I guess. I mean, trying to make her something she's not, so I guess that's not sweet. I don't know. Just, it doesn't seem like, we don't get the sense that Alina has ever been that close to another person, let alone like female, regardless of gender.
Right.
Right.
Oh, true. Because like, it's not like she has any kind of physical relationship with Mal. Like, they don't seem to hug or touch each other in any kind of even friendly way.
Right. And I guess she like kids around with the boys or whatever, right, in the first army, like, right, Mal's friends, but they seem more Mal's friends than her friends.
Yes.
Seems like Mal is her only friend until Jenya, and they have these like really, they share these like really intimate moments together. They're alone together a lot of the time. She's actually like confiding emotionally in someone, which I don't feel like she ever really expressed her emotions to Mal, or else he would not be a surprise that she was so into him.
No, not at all. And we also see Alina sticking up for Jenya when she, for Jenya. Anyways, we see Alina sticking up for her when the other Grisha don't want her around because they think of her in this like objective way. like as an object.
Right.
That kind
objectified.
Of
objectified. Yeah.
They objectify her as a pawn. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, she's a sex worker.
Which she, oh my God, she totally is.
Yeah. And so they look down on her for that, even though, one, the Darkling is asking her to do that, obviously. And two, if you want to be a sex worker, then you should be allowed to be a sex worker.
This is a sex worker positive podcast also.
No shame.
Mm-mm. But she's being forced to do it against her without like her consent, right? So it's
which
like,
is what makes it wrong.
Yeah, yeah,
you
of course.
You can't be forced into sex work. If it's what you want to do, that's fine.
That's like sex slavery.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what the Darkling has turned her into.
But she also has to be the slave to the queen as well. Forced to move in these circles where everyone's talking about her. It's like it's like the quote unquote open secret.
Right. Because everyone knows that she's having sex with the king against her. I don't think they know it's against her will.
Yeah. I think they vilify her.
They definitely do. But Alina is at least a good friend to her in that she says, no, she's my friend. Like she's going to hang out with us. Or, mm-hmm. you know, she doesn't say that, but it's implied.
When does Alina find out that that's what's happening with Jenya?
Jenya says something along the lines of the king gives me too much attention.
But when does she find out that the Darkling's behind it? Or doesn't she actually confront the Darkling about it at some point? And then he's like, I cultivated her gifts and made a gift of her.
Yes.
To the queen.
Which means he knows what's going on with the king.
Oh, yeah, he totally knows. He's manipulating it all.
Otherwise, there's no reason for her to keep up her beauty if she doesn't want to. And I'm not 100% sure if Jenya wants to look the way she looks even, or if it's all just so she can manipulate the king.
Or it's like the one thing that she has and that other people see her as having value, right, is her beauty.
Right.
And her ability to make other people beautiful.
Right. Either way, Alina and Jenya, that's who I ship. I'm never really sure in the story if the Darkling actually likes Alina or if if it's all part of his ruse. Because we get so many facial expressions that seem to be a hint to the fact that the Darkling is actually frustrated that he has feelings for Alina. Now, we're getting all of this from Alina's perspective, so she might be seeing those things because she has feelings for him at the time. But even when he's in the tent talking to her after she's been captured at the end, he seems upset with her feelings towards Mal.
Yeah, we get this sense that he's jealous. And we don't really know if he's jealous because of their feelings for each other or if the Darkling just wants to use her. I mean, he does want to use her. That's a huge part of it. But the other, I think that there's more going on there. I think that he's found someone who's also singular like him.
She's like almost like an equal to him.
Yeah, she's a foil.
Right.
She's just the opposite.
Yeah,
she's light and he's dark. And she's a woman, he's a man. And she's young and he's old.
All the opposites.
Oh, and he does make these comments to her about like being with Mal and trying to like dissuade her from being with Mal. Where he's like, they're just going to resent you for your power. He's never going to be able to understand. So I don't know how much of that is he's like, be with me.
Right.
Or like, be with me so that I can use you better.
Right.
Or is it both?
And part of it, I think, is that we don't have any Darkling backstory. So I don't know if he's ever had a actually like intimate, not like sexually intimate, but emotionally intimate relationship with anyone else.
Because he hates his mom.
He hates his mom.
We didn't even talk about his mom issues.
Which is probably why he hates maybe all women.
And why he feels like he can use Jenya.
Yeah. And Alina and maybe everyone. Because we also don't know anything about his dad. I'm guessing from Kelly's facial expressions, we'll learn more in the next book.
Or in book three, I can't remember.
Okay.
We find out more about his backstory, but it's never really clear. That's kind of why he's an interesting character, right? Is because he is so complicated.
Right. I guess I don't like the idea of an evil character with no backstory because it assumes that they were born that way.
Hmm.
As if, and I'm not saying like, nature over nurture one way or the other, but it often seems like when you encounter people who do truly evil things, there's more than just one or the other to them. And we don't really get that with the Darkling.
We do hear when Bagra is doing the big exposition to Alina and the like bomb drops, right? And we learn about the Darkling and who he is, and he's actually like the same person the whole time, and Bagra's like 1,000 years old or something. And doesn't she take responsibility at some point? She's like, I pushed him to be exceptional and to like develop these abilities.
Yeah, she does say that, but I'm wondering in what way one magical person pushes someone to this brink of evil in their magical powers. If they only have a specific amount of magic and they need an amplifier to make it greater, then didn't he have the power to be at this powerful all along?
Doesn't he say that like using your power makes you more powerful? It's like this positive feedback loop, right? So the more you have of it to begin with means you have more of it to use, and the more you use it, the more of it you then develop and have to use, right? And it just keeps building off itself, and that extends life for Grisha. And because he is so powerful to begin with, he's just like lived super long. But I do think that like there is this sort of question of who's responsible and how to like what's accountable, who's accountable for like the thing, for the actions he takes. And certainly he's using Alina in inappropriate ways, and other women also. Yes. But there's something like, one thing this novel does really well is it crafts that tension between them, I think. Also, because we're in Shipwrecked, everyone's straight.
Everyone's straight.
Not in the world.
No,
in this book.
In this book.
I guess we live in a world where heteronormativity is forced upon us.
Yes.
Right? And that certainly seems to be the case in this world as well.
Yeah. And it's very frustrating because we actually, and not just only straight people, straight white people.
Straight white cis people.
Able-bodied?
Yes. Totally magical able-bodied. They're even more than able-bodied. They're like super able-bodied. Let's talk about sexy times.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
There was a makeout scene with the Darkling at the Winter Fate, and it was pretty tame, to be honest.
It was a building of sexual tension with no release.
For me as a reader.
For me as a reader, or Alina.
Or the Darkling.
Or the Darkling. Yeah, there's no sexy times.
And we do get, it's almost like this anxious scene that's full of shame, like you were saying earlier. And we get the sense that everything's like out of control. Like she's blushed and I don't know, she just is like, I don't think, we get the sense that like she has never had this, like this is the most intense sexual encounter she's ever had.
Yes.
They're having so much sex at Grisha Hogwarts.
Oh my God, of course they are. What else are they doing? There's nothing to do all day. And the bathhouses.
Oh my God, bathhouses.
The totally. Banya?
The banya. Yeah, they're like, they're releasing all their pent up energy, sparring with each other. Yeah. And
Alina talks about how like Anna Kuya hated the bathhouses because it's like an excuse for like people to get
like
naked.
Immoral and, behavior.
Yeah, be frivolous.
Being naked, like the amount of clothes you wear is not associated, should not be associated to morality at all.
No, some people want to wear no clothes and I think that's fine.
That's great. Great for them.
Yeah, good for them. All right, now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot, structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in the segment called Kill Your Darlings. In the first and last chapter, we get third person, probably omniscient, limited?
It's kind of focused. It's focused on the boy and the girl.
Yeah, and exactly both of those two chapters, before and after, talk about the boy and the girl. They don't even give them their names, we find out in the middle part of the book. It's Alina and Mal, and in the after we're supposed to assume it's them. There's no reason to assume it's anyone else,
right?
And then this whole middle part we get is Alina's first person point of view, and for me that was a strange choice and made it feel like maybe I shouldn't trust everything Alina says.
I think that's a fair assessment because she has a limited perspective. She's naive and innocent. She's what, 16, I think, when the majority of this stuff happens? 18?
I have no idea. She's in the army. So from an American perspective, I just assumed she was 18.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the age of entering military services in other countries.
In Ravka.
Yeah, in Ravka.
In a magical country.
in a magical
fictional country.
Where people can live to be 120 plus years old.
Mm-hmm. I didn't interpret it as a, I didn't find it particularly jarring. And I think that's because the first time I encountered this text was as an audiobook.
Right.
So it seemed like it almost created this like ethereal ghost story. Like I'm suspended. I want to know more. I don't know. For me as like the reader/listener, that's kind of more the place that it put me in. And then when we access Elena's perspective in chapter one, I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be the rest of the book. And then it kind of, it's bookended, right? Because the same thing happens at the end of that, the end of this novel is the boy and the girl. Although I'm curious, it's interesting that it infantilizes them again. After we see them develop so much as characters and kind of come into adulthood, at least like baby adulthood.
One, they are adults. They're in the military. Like, they're not children.
Right.
It is an interesting choice.
But at the beginning of the novel, the boy and the girl, they're actually talking about,
right,
like 8-year-olds or whatever. But at the end of the novel, it takes them back there. I don't know if it's almost like circling back to this sort of suspension of time when they were together in their childhood growing up, because they do escape. Mal and Elena escape together and have this sort of this time together on the ship.
But maybe that is what the point is, because in the beginning they talk about their meadow and going on these kind of pretend adventures, and now they're finally going on a real adventure together. So maybe it is supposed to bring us back to like to the beginning.
Right. And it's like spiraling. It's not an actual circle, right? There actually is development there. So they're not coming back to the exact same place, but there is this sort of spiralic movement where they're coming back to a similar dynamic between the two, but that's been changed. I would assume it have to have been changed by their life experiences.
Also, they kiss, which is like basically nothing, but they obviously mean very something vanilla to them.
we were waiting for it for a long time.
Yeah, and it didn't come till the very end. The other thing I thought that was interesting about doing the third person at the beginning and the end is we don't see that much in YA. A lot of young adult is from the first person.
It's a really good point, because it's so focused on this sort of finding yourself, character development sort of narratives. We don't get a lot of omniscient third person.
Even if we want more information about a different place in a world in YA or whatever, different perspective, they just change the character whose perspective we are seeing.
Right, yeah, we just get a multiple POV story.
Which I love.
Yes.
So it was an interesting choice to do third person at the beginning and the end to me.
That's a good point, because YA is so predicated upon creating a relationship with this individual characters a lot of the time, right? You're meant to identify with Harry.
Yeah. But he's not first person.
That's fair. It's not first person, but it's definitely like focalized. It is. Fair point. But YA in general is very much like you have a central character for the majority of the texts, right?
Right.
And the reader is encouraged to identify them and with them. And one of the ways the authors do that is by giving you a first person narrative. We recommend Shadow and Bone if you like Chosen One stories particularly, but also if you want something that's not medieval based fantasy.
Could be good for younger people, like younger YA readers, because there is no sex in it. It's not particularly violent.
Not really.
That whole cutting people in half thing's a little, yeah, but it's not like descriptive of blood and gore and whatever.
Thanks for listening to the very first episode of JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of Tomi Adeyemi's incredible debut novel, Children of Blood and Bone. And watch out for the occasional mini-sode about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions. And you can find the show notes and more about the podcast and about Jesse and Kelly at jkmagicpod.com.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on the podcast app of your choice. And if you're feeling benevolent, we'd really appreciate it if you'd rate and review the show, particularly on Apple Podcasts. See you in a fortnight.